Anyways, it is 8:30. I know Mark likes to start at 8:31, but we will start by wishing two things. First of all, I want to wish Mark, Dr. Shapiro, a mazel tov on the bris of his grandson yesterday morning. So just want to wish him a special mazel tov. And we had the pleasure of hosting him in our home on Shabbat. Timing worked out really well. And was sort of our first scholar in residence, really, in since February of 2020. So it was a pleasure having him. He spoke 9 times in Toronto in the 30 hours that he was visiting our city. And I think it was a very nice, we were seeing somebody in our Armenian, the 25th yahrzeit of their father. So anyways, it was very nice. So I want to thank him. And just to let you know, if any of your shuls are, you know, are getting back in the scholar in residence business, it's you can I'll put in a plug for Mark. It's really it's a pleasure having him, not just for the shiurim. You know what the Gemara says, that it's this week's, like Parsha, Yafesi Chatan Shel Abdei Avot. You know, the schmoozing with people is often more interesting and more informative than the actual Torah learning that we do. So I want to thank you. I know we enjoyed the weekend very much. And mazel tov, we should have lots of happy occasions. And now it's even 8:32, so we're 1 minute behind as we talk on Zacharia Frankel. Vakasha, Dr. Okay. Mark.
Thank you. And yes, it was a lot of fun, very enjoyable, especially to see. I met listeners of the classes in Toronto as well. Let me begin by saying that one of the listeners told me about this book. You can see it, Zacharias Frankel, Defiant Jewish Educator, by Rabbi Rebecca Kushner. And believe it or not, in the second paragraph of the book, someone who's listening to us right now was mentioned as having introduced the author to Zacharias Frankel. The book really doesn't deal with the materials I focus on, but it certainly is a nice discussion if you're interested in learning about aspects of Zacharias Frankel, especially his approach to education. A few points before I begin. Thank you, Mike. I misspoke when I said that the famous story that when Rav Soloveitchik's wife came back from the hospital, I said she found the dishes, milk and meat in the dishwasher. I didn't mean dishwasher. I meant in the sink. Dishwasher, Rav Avadya says you could put milk and meat in a dishwasher, but as far as I know, the Rav never held it. Right at the end of last class, we had some discussion about Yom Kippur. Why Yom Kippur? We don't have a Yom Tov Sheni for Yom Kippur. And someone mentioned that he heard that the reason was because the people wouldn't accept it. We spoke about this idea that you can't have a decree on the people unless they accept it. I said I never heard that. And I looked, and I still haven't found anything like that. I did find there's discussion in the Gemara, in Rosh Hashanah, in Pesachim, about celebrating or observing Yom Kippur for 2 days. It mentions in Rosh Hashanah, Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph, of one rabbi who did so. I also found a tshuva. If you want all the sources, take a look at Rav Yaakov Epstein. He has a sefer Chevel Nachal Aso. Let's see, it's Chelek Yud Zion, Simon Yud Tes, and you have all the makoros, all the sources, and including how throughout Jewish history you had Gedol Yisrael who did observe Yom Kippur for 2 days, not just in terms of fasting. They didn't do any malacha, but they also would wear tefillin on the second, it seems. He discusses what he mentions, the Yerushalmi that says that one rabbi actually fasted 2 days and died. So we know that's a lesson. You're not supposed to fast more than 1 day. There's basically a klal that existed when they were Mekadesh Chodesh that Lo Matzinu Elul Mubar, that we basically don't find Elul, an extra day in Elul. Occasionally there would be, but generally not. So that's that also gave a justification for not being concerned about a second day of Yom Kippur. He discusses how in the first period when they were Mekadesh Chodesh and they used the flames, that then there was never an issue because everyone all over the country knew when Rosh Hashanah was. The second period when they sent shluchim and he says they sent shlichim, But that's a mistake. Actually, the poro in rabbinic Hebrew of a messenger is not shlichim, it's shluchim. Like the Rambam says, shluchim v'shutfim. I don't know about modern Hebrew, but definitely not rabbinic Hebrew. And that was when the people wouldn't get there by Yom Kippur, so that would have created a suffolk. And then there was Gedol Yisrael who accepted upon themselves. And then once you had the luach, now the second day is only a minhag, or it's a gezera from the sages, like a minhag, to observe the minhag, to observe it as a minhag. In that case, there really is no reason to for them to be mitake and to observe 2 days Yom Kippur. And let's see. Okay, but you can take a look if you want. The Rav Yah, he's very upset with the people who would want to do 2 days of Yom Tov. And he quotes here the Rush. The Torah quotes the Rush. He's also very upset about this. But like I said, you can get all the sources here, so I don't need to spend any more time on this. Someone who listens to the classes confirmed with from Rav Schechter, or it's confirmed earlier, Rav Schechter's position is not that you keep 1 day if you go as a tourist. His position is that if you're there with your family and they're keeping 1 day, you should keep 1 day. If you're by yourself, I think his position is you keep 1.5, what they call 1.5, not 2 days. Now, I want to say something else, and this relates to what Rabbi Kelman said at the end of last class, and one of you asked about it, so let me clarify it. The Shulchan Aruch, if you look in, he has a whole section, Dina Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios, that's Tov Tzadi Vav, in Simf Gimel, he talks about if you're in the land of Israel and you go to Chutz La'aretz, then you can't do Malacha on Yom Tov, even if you intend to return. Unless you haven't reached a settlement, like if you show up at the airport, that's why I said that if you show up, if you fly from Israel and you show up Yom Tov Sheni at the airport and there's no Jewish community there, then you'd be able to do Malacha. But once you reach it, you can't, and it doesn't matter whether you're in public or not in public, according to the Shulchan Aruch. However, I asked the question, why is there no reference then to people going from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael? It only has the reverse. And Rabbi Kelman said, it never happened. It was very unusual. You don't need to. I don't know why it would be more unusual to go from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael than the reverse. But I have to say, b'mechilat kvodo haram, it's really not true that they had Jews that were coming. There was, in Gaonic times, and then later days of Shulchan Aruch, there was a practice of aliyah l'regel. And if you look in Rav Yosef Karo, he wrote a volume of Tshuvot called Avkat Rochel, number 26. That's where he gives his opinion. And then there's a whole discussion. The tradition was that yeshiva students who came to Eretz Yisrael, they would keep 1 day because the idea was that they might end up staying there and they might marry. But people who were married would keep 2 days. And this is what Maran says. Mishaba mechutz la'aretz Eretz Yisrael v'day to lachzor havei b'chal b'yechutz la'aretz ninu. That if you come from, this is what Shulchan Aruch saying in the 15th century, 16th century, you come to Eretz Yisrael to return, you are lechutz la'aretz. And then he says, quote, v'chein asim b'chol yom b'chol shana v'shana olim l'shalosh regalim mechutz la'aretz la'aretz. He says that this is a common practice, that people would come, and they would come. They'd come from Egypt, and they'd come from Iraq. They'd come from Eretz Yisrael to Yerushalayim as a quasi-aliyah l'regel, just like we do today. The people have money. They go, they stay in the Waldorf and the King David. They do a whole aliyah l'regel, but it's they used to do that in the olden days also. And what does he tell us? V'osim yom sheni Shalgolios ketikunav uchamishpatav b'chutz la'aretz. Maran is telling us that they would come up and they would do 2 days. And then, listen to this. This is also interesting. I don't think Rav Schechter would approve, perhaps. The lo'o, not only this, ela shemit kabtzim minyan b'chutz la'aretz olim rego. They grab a whole group of people from chutz la'aretz and they make a minyan, and they would have a minyan and they'd read the Torah and read the special Haftorah and all the brachos, just like they do Yom Tov Sheni. And this was done in front of the Gedolim, and no one ever questioned it. So then why did I say that Rav Schachter might not like it? Because he says, because then he continues, and those who find it difficult, Heyach mitpalim tefilat yontam b'far hesed b'eretz Yisrael. How is it that they're davening, chutz la'aretz davening in public? They're not going privately, they're doing it in public, in a shul. How come they're not concerned with lo yishana adam ibn amachoket, that you're not, blotit kodadu, you're not supposed to do differently? He says, "V'ayishana adam ibn amachoket." He said, "V'hayam maspiko hem shipalot tefilot chutz la'aretz b'tzina." He says they should have davened, these people are claiming that they should have davened chutz la'aretz davening privately, but they're doing it publicly. What does the Shulchan Aruch say? It must be that the great rabbis who've seen this and haven't commented on it, that this is not an issue of machlokas. The only time we're worried about not to differ and create machlokas is when it comes to doing malacha and things of that nature. So, example, someone from Eretz Yisrael comes to Chutz La'aretz and publicly does malacha when everyone else is observing Yom Tov. That is no good. Aval b'tfila. But if you daven publicly, have a whole minyan at the kotel of Chutz La'aretz people, he says that's not a problem. And he says explicitly that although malacha you couldn't do it, tefila sharia b'far hesya, you can do it b'far hesya. So that's the Shulchan Aruch, and my question, I think, remains. Why didn't Rav Yosef Karo feel it important to mention the halacha of going to Eretz Yisrael? Now, this is significant, because we know Rav Yosef Karo's opinion. I just told you, but it's not in the Shulchan Aruch. And there's a whole tradition. In fact, I spoke about this in Toronto over Shabbos. The whole tradition among various authorities, including the whole Moroccan halacha tradition, and they're Sfardim, so they accept the Shulchan Aruch, that they only accept the book, the Shulchan Aruch. They don't accept Rav Yosef Karo as an individual. So the fact that Rav Yosef Karo tells us in a responsum that people, when you go to Eretz Yisrael, you should observe 2 days, that's not binding. Because it's only binding if it's in the Shulchan Aruch, if it's in the Tshuvot, or if it's in, even if he says something in the Shulchan Aruch in the Beit Yosef, and he retracts it in the Bet HaKabayit. The Bet HaKabayit is the same for his editions where he retracts it. The Moroccan halachic tradition, others say we do not accept that because it's not Rav Yosef Karo, the man that we accept. Rather, it's the book, the Shulchan Aruch. And since the Shulchan Aruch says nothing about this, we're not bound to it. That's what he says. Okay, let me pick up now where we left off. Let me get my svarim, my books, so I have them handy. You recall, I went through a number of sources that really can be seen as a justification or illustration of Frankl's idea of the folk, that is that the people, there's sort of like a revelation through the people. And if you want to know what's acceptable, what's not, you look at the people, obviously the religious people. And I showed you even the Rambam in Hilchos Mamrin, where the Kesef Mishnah says that, in his opinion, what the Rambam says is that if the people start, observe the halacha and then they stop observing it, in the future, a Beis Din could, but it has to be a Beis Din, like a Sanhedrin, not just a local Beis Din, they could get rid of the rabbinic decree, prohibition, obligation, whatever it is, because the people weren't doing it anymore. And I mentioned the Rashi's opinion is that, no, once the people accept it, you can never change it again. By the way, Rav Yaakov, the late Yaakov Blitstein, Gerald Blitstein, who Rav Lichtenstein regarded as the Rav's, Rav Soloveitchik's best student. Hold on, I have a book here. In this book, some who married Hilchot HaRamba, basically it's a commentary on Hilchos Mamrim, chapters 1 through 4, an academic Torah commentary, very, very good commentary. He mentions, he quotes, you know, this is a hard thing to understand. In general, the concept we were talking about of Chazal make a decree, the people don't listen to it. And because the people don't listen to it, then it's not binding. Why should it not be binding? If the people, if the Chazal make the decree, how do I understand this? And he quotes from Meir Don Plotsky, the author of the Klei Chemda, who explains, he explains that if you refuse to listen to a Gezerah of Chazal, then it doesn't take, it's not applicable. And then the question he asks is, well, how can you give normative legitimacy to people who don't listen to Chazal? Isn't there a Pasuk in the Torah, Lo Sasor, you should not depart from what Chazal tell you? So now you're going to say that the people violate a biblical commandment. They don't listen to what the rabbis say. And because they don't listen to rabbis say, if enough of them don't, if enough of them sin like this, therefore it, it's no longer binding. And he quotes Rav Moshe Mitrani, who derives this from the Rambam, that when we say that the prohibition of Lo Sasor, that is, do not depart from what the sages tell you, that's only if, as a matter of principle, you say that I do not accept the authority of the rabbis to decree this. So therefore, let's say you have a whole community, and the community says, we do not accept the authority of the rabbis to issue this decree. Then it won't apply. In such a case, the fact that the majority, even the overall majority, don't follow, like let's say they don't follow, they don't accept Purim as a holiday, because we do not believe that the sages had the authority to institute this, or we don't believe they should have instituted it. Something like, you know, that it was wrong. Then it won't apply. What he says is, however, if you don't accept the decree because you find it difficult, you don't understand it, whatever, but not because as a matter of principle you reject it, that's what we're talking about. And you can see the Chemda on in Parshas Hazinu, who elaborates on it, which is an interesting position. I don't know anyone else who says this, that, but it makes perfect sense, because how can you understand if people would say that the rabbis don't have the authority to do this and it's not binding, that's a biblical violation of not to depart from what the rabbis tell you. However, if it's just too difficult, if they, that's what it means, they're not able to follow it, that's what it means. And that's what Zachariah Frankel is talking about also. He says that when you look at the people, you're looking at the people who are observant. And for whatever reason, and I'm going to give you examples today, they're not following the laws. So, shkoyach to the late Professor Blitzstein, who was really such a, he won the Pras Yisrael, such a great scholar. Now, Frankel, in discussing what makes a practice binding and what makes it have continuing legitimacy, he cites what we said, that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi rejected the practice of, he said, you don't have to follow the practice of shamanakum, of non-Jewish oil. What's the point of Frankel mentioning this? Granted, he's saying that the laws depend on the people's acceptance, but he's doing this in an article that talks about when reforms are legitimate. So the implication of what he's saying is that if the people no longer accept something, you can let it, and he's going to actually say, you know, basically die a slow death, then be forgotten. But wait a second here. There's no Sanhedrin in 19th century Germany. So what's Frankel talking about? Is he saying that we have the authority today to uproot commandments, to say they're no longer binding? We no longer need to follow them? That's not what he's saying. He's using this as an example to really to make an analogy. He's not saying that we can today formally decree or declare that a certain rabbinic practice can't be followed. He's only bringing this example of Shemanakum to show that at the end of the day, what the people decide is going to determine the legitimacy of something as it goes on. And I know that this might sound quasi-reformist, and it might not be, quote, orthodox, but I'm also going to cite you a number of examples to show that Frankel has strong support for this. Now, he says, let me just read you from Waxman. Again, he translated the article, his article on changes in Judaism. He says that when a new ordinance was about to be enacted, it was necessary to see whether it would find acceptance. When the people allow certain practices to fall into disuse, then the practice ceases to exist. There is, in such cases, no danger for faith. That is, when the reformers decree that you don't have to do X, Y, and Z, that's a destruction of Judaism. But when the religious people on their own, a practice falls out of fashion, Then it falls out of fashion and is no longer binding, and it doesn't destroy faith because it was organic in the way that it stopped being practiced. A people used to activity will not hurt itself and will not destroy its practices. Its own sense of religiosity warns against it. Only those practices from which it is entirely estranged and which yield it no satisfaction will be abandoned and will die of itself. Then he says, we have then reached a decisive point regarding moderate changes, namely that they must come from the people and that the will of the entire community must decide. And he goes on to speak about this. Okay, so is this non-Orthodox, that the people can decide, even if you're telling me that the people are religious Jews? Granted, if they're Mechalei Shabbos, they can't decide. But let's say they are Mechalei Shabbos, but they decide, for whatever reason, to stop observing this practice or that practice. Now, granted, we're not speaking about Horat Shah here, an emergency practice, where even no less a figure than Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, take a look at his Tshuvos, Orach Chaim, number Kuf Nun Dalet. He says as follows, quote, in Yiru Tamidei Chachamim V'Godrei Geder L'Hafer Torah L'Fiyaz Man V'Makomos, if the great sages were speaking post-Talmudic, see that in accordance with the time and the place, they need to basically abolish the rabbinic practices. What does he say? Yiskabtsu V'Yisu V'Yitnu Pe'el Pe'. They should come together, or they should do it with letters one to another, and then they can decide. So the Chasam Sofer says that post-Talmudic sages can also, if they feel it's an emergency measure, if they need to, for whatever reason, they're the Gedolei Yisrael, they can decide that certain practices are no longer binding as a temporary emergency measure. But that's not letting the practice fall by the wayside permanently, like the language of Frankel was. Only those practices, the practices will die of themselves. So it seems quasi-reformist, but I don't think so. I'll tell you why. Because there are a number of examples of matters that we know that when large segments of the religious population over time stopped following it, they fell by the wayside, and later generations of the Gedolei Yisrael, sometimes they tried to bring it back, but other times they were Melamed Zchus. There was this assumption among the rabbis that the Jewish community is a Kehila Kedosha. And if practices, for reasons we can't even understand, fall by the wayside and they don't follow it, even though it appears to be black letter halacha, since we see that the community as a whole was not doing it, there must be some justification or some reason. And you have a situation where you find great poskim trying to be Melamed Zchus, sometimes even throwing up their hands and saying, I don't understand it. I don't see why this is the way it is. But this is Minhag Yisrael and Minhag Yisrael Torah. Sometimes they even use the expression Minhag Mevato Halacha, which means that, it's often said that Minhag Mevato Halacha only applies to monetary matters. It's not true. It's used in application to other areas as well. Menachem Elon, in his book, who's greater than Menachem Elon? In his book, Mishpat Ivri, says it only applies to monetary matters, but Bechila Kvodo also, it's not true. There's plenty of examples of Vachronim who use the phrase Minag Bavata Ha'acha to refer to matters in, not in Choshen Mishpat, but in Yoredeya. And they say, we don't understand the reason, but this is the practice. Therefore, we have to apply the concept of Minhag, the Minhag of the Kehila Kadosha. Is Mevato what appears to be the halacha based on the written text? We don't have an answer, and I'm going to give you some in a few minutes of what I'm speaking about. In general, this is an interesting issue, a debate, what we're speaking about here. Can you say in traditional communities that Jewish law has changed? On the one hand, you might want to say, well, why not say Jewish law has changed? It's changed through the activities of the Gedolei Poskim, and they're the only ones who could change it. And we do have people who say that. On the other hand, others are insistent. If you look in Rabbi Bleich's writings, he says, for instance, there was a big debate on this topic in Judaism, the journal Judaism. It doesn't exist anymore, this journal, but there was a number of important matters in this journal Judaism. In the winter of 1980, Jeremiah Bleich says, quote, and he put it in italics, Jewish law does not change. from Rabbi Black's perspective, anything you see, any what looks like changes, that's just new applications. But on the other hand, Marvin Fox, in the very same symposium, writes, quote, Jewish law has certainly changed over the centuries. And from Marvin Fox's perspective, the important thing is who is doing the changing. That is, the Gedolei HaPoskim have the authority to change matters based on that they reread the Talmud. And they come up with a completely new reading. That means that what we understood until now was the halacha, now is no longer the halacha. Now, it could be this is all semantics, and Rabbi Black would say, well, it's not a change, but in reality, it is a change. Because until now, we did X, and now the great Posek is telling us that what we did was wrong, and now we're doing Y. So our practice is completely changing. And in fact, I found Rabbi Black himself says about an issue we've spoken about before, the issue of writing a Sefer Torah. There's a mitzvah that we have to write everyone has to write a Sefer Torah, and Rosh Rabbi Yechiel of Toledo says that today we fulfill this by buying Sfarim. And in Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume 2, Rabbi Bosch says as follows, page 13 in the introduction, quote, it is beyond dispute that the Rosh maintains that a change has occurred in the statutory requirement of fulfilling the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah. So Rabbi Bosch is saying that a change has occurred. Now that we have Sfarim, there's a change. I remember that I mentioned that when I was in yeshiva already, we asked, one of my classmates asked from David Miller, how is what the Rosh said not a reformist position? The Torah, according to the Torah, you have to write a Sefer Torah, and the Rosh says, no, you don't have to because you have Sfarim. And to his credit, Rav Miller thought about it. He said he doesn't know the answer. It's an interesting question. But this is a debate among Orthodox thinkers. How much can you speak about change in halacha? And by the way, it's not a Haredi modern Orthodox thing. You can find plenty of very traditional Hasidic texts, regular traditional texts that also speak about the power of poskim to make changes. And then you can find other expressions that are more Bleichian, if you want to put it that way. Listen to what the late Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, whose second Yortzeit we just observed. He has an article called Creativity and Innovation in Halacha, and he says as follows. Remember, the question is, does Halacha change? So we saw Rabbi Bleich says no, and Marvin Fox says yes, and Rabbi Sachs says Torah does not change, Halacha does. Halacha changes precisely because Torah does not change. For halacha is the application of Torah to a changing world. Now, whether all these are just semantic disputes between Blech, Fox, and Sachs, I don't think so. I think it's more substantive about, and Rabbi Blech's position has been challenged by many as being too dogmatic, even fundamentalist-like, in his description of how halacha operates. Formalistic is the term used. In fact, Rabbi Blech says that, quote, modernity is irrelevant to the formulation of halachic decision-making, and I don't understand how anyone can make such a statement when it is beyond obvious that modernity is certainly very obvious, because the whole concept of Chodesh Hashem in the Torah is, as we saw, it has to do with modernity. And the Chasam Sofer telling us that now we have to decide differently because of the threats we're facing because of the irreligious. So I think perhaps Rabbi Blech uses dogmatic expressions and formulations in a polemical vein, because to me, it's I don't understand how he could say that. Now, the academic study of Jewish law has documented change in all periods. If you look at the writings of Yaakov Katz and Chaim Soloveitchik, Ephraim Urbach, and others, that's all they focus on. That's what they do. And by change, I mean that halachic obligations are seen as different in different generations. Now, the posek often will say that it's all inherent in the system. But that's a dogmatic position that the historian is not interested in. The historian's only interested in showing you how people understood the halacha differently. So in Generation X, the halacha was understood to mean one thing. In Generation Y, the halacha was understood to mean something completely different. And the historian will try to show why the change of halacha happened. And Chaim Soloveitchik speaks about the angle of deflection. That's the expression he uses. He thinks that usually we can see that how halacha would develop organically, and if we see that it doesn't, that it goes off in a completely different direction, that then, and only then, can you look to outside factors and say that these outside factors is what forced a reevaluation and a change in development of the halacha from what would naturally happen. That position of Soloveitchik has been challenged by others, Adiel Schremer and others, and it is a conservative position, namely Soloveitchik's position. Although if you read some of Soloveitchik's writings, I mean, he has a whole article called The Religious Law and Change that deals with the situation in medieval times where his argument is that before the Tosafists were confronted with the persecutions that led to not just mass suicide, but even killing of children among the Jewish population, there was no doubt in anyone's mind that suicide was inappropriate and killing children was certainly murder and absolutely incorrect. However, faced with the fact that you have all these pious communities that did this and they couldn't conclude, it just was a psychological impossibility for the Baalei Tosfot to conclude that all these pious communities who died al Kiddush Hashem, or I should say killed themselves and their children al Kiddush Hashem, to regard them as murderers and suicides, that was a psychological impossibility. So Soloveitchik argues that this led to reinterpretation of the text and revision of the halacha. Very Frankelian, Soloveitchik, although someone once asked him about this, and he said that a friend of mine actually asked him about this, and he said, nothing I do relates to modernity. Everything I do is medieval. In other words, don't cite what I'm saying to support Frankl's approach or anything else. But that's the argument. And as I said, you can create a coherent theology that post-scheme have the right to their interpretations, not by changing, not changing the principles, but changing the practices. Eating in the sukkah, I mean, what do you say if throughout all of Jewish history, people ate in the sukkah, Shmini Atzeres, and then the Hasidim come around and come up with a new conception of Shmini Atzeres and don't eat in the sukkah? By the way, I'm not agreeing necessarily that the Hasidim are the reason only for this, although in the Brisker world, they blame it all on the Hasidim. But we do have examples of Hasidim coming up with new practices. We have examples of Chabad coming up with new practices. So the practice of eating in the sukkah when it's raining, that's a common Hasidic thing now, even though according to the Shulchan Aruch, you're not supposed to, you're not supposed to make a bracha. In the Hasidic world, dafka, you're supposed to. It could be pouring thunder. Thunderstorms, all that, you're supposed to say in the sukkah, you're supposed to make a bracha. If that's not a new halacha based on a new understanding that no one in history ever knew about, I don't know what is. Now, what was Katz's approach? He showed the following pattern. I'm now going to read you what Moshe Halbertal, how Moshe Halbertal has described it. Quote, the community facing a change in its circumstances creates norms that are based not necessarily on halachic sources, but on what Katz calls the community's ritual instinct. The community creates such norms organically, without negotiation with rabbinic authority, and sometimes on the basis of advice received from educated dilettantes who have not attained the status to rule authoritatively on legal questions. After the norms have become rooted, halachic authorities examine them in light of legal sources. And then he explains, sometimes they consent to them ex post facto, sometimes they reject them, and sometimes they reinterpret the halakhic sources. So you have practices that develop from the community, a pious community, and faced with the fait accompli, often the post scheme are led to justify it, either through rereading the halakhic sources, or just saying that we don't understand how this is, but this is the practice, and we accept it. This is exactly what Frankl is doing. Katz, in his autobiography, mentions that he once expressed this opinion, the whole Katz approach to the study of Jewish law, which has been enormously influential. In fact, it's been said that Chaim Soloveitchik was more influenced by Yaakov Katz than by his own father, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. I don't know if that's true, but that's what someone, Rabbi Rakefet, actually said, that certainly in his career choice and that writing, he was more influenced by Katz, but that's because he's a historian, and Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, Dov Soloveitchik, is not a historian. But in his autobiography, he mentions that when he was in Frankfurt, after describing some of his ideas, someone says, but that's not orthodox. And Katz said, replied, quote, Well, history is not orthodox then. I'll bring these up, quote, next week. His point is that you, Frankfurt Hersheyans, you're starting with your conclusion, and then you want to, massage the history till you get to there. But I'm telling you how I see it, and you can't come to me and say dogmatically, but that's not orthodox, because my response is, well, then history is not orthodox. I'll read you the exact quote next class. And for those who don't know, Yaakov Katz was a very firm Jew, religious. I mean, but his approach to the study of Jewish law is a historical approach, which is Frankl's approach. Now, Frankl was looking at it, however, not just historically, but he's seeing it theologically, whereas Katz is just a historian. In fact, I would say that for the historians, and Frankl is going to fall into this category, and this is what's going to create the problems with Hirsch, and more so, we're going to get to Halacha Moshe Sinai next class, I bet. But when you, from the historian's eyes, there are a number of cases where you see that basically you have, as I said, the Halacha has been rewritten, as it were, new understandings, which again, theologically, this never troubled me, because if, let's say, the Tosafists could give a new understanding, what's the problem if the next generation of Tosafists could also give a new understanding? The fact that they're giving a new understanding based upon the practices of the community and the mass suicides or something, what's the difference? What's the difference? Why they give new interpretations? If they come up with a new understanding, now it's a new halacha, that murder of children can be justified, so fine. That's I don't really see what the problem is here. There are even some poskim who agree with the historians in these matters. For instance, I'll just give you one example. A figure we've spoken about in the past, and I'll speak about in a few weeks on my trip to Morocco, Rav Sholem Messas, the chief rabbi of Morocco, later chief rabbi of Jerusalem. He was quite an astute posek, and he's dealing in one of his tshuvot, in Shemesh HaMagen, volume 2, page 249, he's dealing with the practice. The Rambam says women have to wear these veils, the shawls, not the shawls, the veils. The Rambam says that. And he says that the abandonment of this practice was not due to the rabbis, but the people on their own. That is, the people revolted against it. He says, quote, "The masses are the one who abolished the practice little by little. At first, the rabbis scream at them, and the people don't pay attention, and little by little, it's abolished." And that's basically the historical approach. You know, there's been a good deal written about how everything I described was how medieval Ashkenaz did matters, but not Sfarad, not medieval Sfarad. I have to say that I can't speak to medieval Sfarad, but I can tell you about later Sfarad, that is the last few hundred years, which I know well, and I know there's no difference. You find sages in Sephardic lands doing the same thing the medieval Ashkenazic sages did. That is, you have a Kila Kadosha with a certain practice, and the people, the post-game in the Sephardic countries also try to be Melamed Zchus and throw up their hands and say, we don't know how this can be justified, but this is what the people do, and the people are a holy people, therefore we must accept it. Now, the medieval Ashkenaz is famous for doing this, even egregious violations. For instance, we know that in medieval times, Jews did not wear tefillin in Ashkenaz. How do we know Jews didn't wear tefillin? Because, well, we have the Smog telling us about it. Tosafot asks, one of the Tosafists, he sees these are religious people are not doing it, so he says, on what do they rely? Now, I can't know for sure what's going through this Tosafist's mind, but I assume he assumes that the Jews are religious, holy people, and God would not simply allow them to fall into sin. So therefore, he asks, al mahim somchim. That is, he's assuming from the get-go that there must be some justification for this practice. And in the end, everything I've described really approximates the views of Zacharia Frankl that there's this dialectic here between the sources, the halachic sources, and the practice of the community, a pious community. And Jewish history and the halachic history, the history of halacha, is not just the sources. It's the sources in this complex interplay with the practice of the religious masses. And that's where we get our practices. Sometimes they're more strict than the text would have it. Sometimes they're less strict. And sometimes they're right in line. And I'll add, since I mentioned Chaim Soloveitchik, I'll add one more point, which Soloveitchik notes in his article, Rupture and Reconstruction. I don't know if he explicitly mentions in the article, but he's mentioned it in talks I've heard him, that all these chumras that people speak about are not really chumras in the sense that people often imagine. Rather, these are returning in a number of cases to what the halacha is in the books. For whatever reason, for hundreds of years, people adopted certain practices that are not necessarily in line with what the book law is. But this was the minhag. But now, with the immigration to America and the creation of new communities, we've now left the mimetic culture and gone back to the book culture. That Soloveitchik obviously stresses this. But it's the other point is that many of the so-called chumras are not really chumras. I think of a chumra as if the general practice is X, and you have one commentary on the side of the daf from the Shulchan Aruch who says, yesh noagin, so then people adopt this as a chumra. That's not what I'm speaking of. Many of the things that people look at and say are chumras today, these are actually the rov minyan ubinyan, the majority position of halacha, which for one reason or another just was not practiced. But now that we've gone back to a book tradition, if you open up the books, this is the halacha. And if you're going to use books, not tradition, to be the determining factor, and you see the Shulchan Aruch says it, then the Ramah, and all the poskim on the side, what, you're going to rely now because the Aruch HaShulchan is Malamed Tzvos? No. Now we can reach maximum compliance. That is, we don't need to rely on kulas. Let me just give you a few examples, though, from traditional sources that are in line with Frankel's notion of a Kehila Kadosha, that we can look to the Kehila Kadosha, their practices, and that this itself is a source of a revelation and can determine a halacha. I have a whole list of this, of sources, which is going to appear in an article that I'm writing, which should appear soon, in an article on all these matters I'm speaking about. Here is Rav Eliyahu Ragoler. He wrote Yad Eliyahu. He's not so well known today, but a well-known authority in the previous century. Listen to this. I'll read it in Hebrew. Demasha haminhag muska meitzal kol Yisrael. The fact that you have a minhag, a practice with the Jewish people, hu al pi ruach hakodesh. This is based on ruach hakodesh. What ruach hakodesh? Shashem yisparach hofia beinehem. That is, the Jewish people have a ruach hakodesh. Umamash kapi navi hinhigu ki al yedei haratzon v'amasa l'shem shemayim meir Hashem yisparach b'chal k'neses Yisrael ruach hakodesh eishli na'ech dinhog. That is, the Jewish people, as the kiel kadosha, their actions as the Jewish people embody a ruach hakodesh. Here is Rav Shlomo Laniado, Syrian sage, and his shuvas based in Osho Shlomo, Orachaim number 17. Shekol ma shenahagu Yisrael shchina muskem esimahem. Everything that Bnei Yisrael, that Kol Yisrael does, again, we're talking about religious Jews here. If this is the general minhag, you must assume that God is in agreement with it, because the Jewish people as a whole would not adopt a practice like this if it wasn't in line with Torah, with God's will. Pidal quotes a rabbi. His name was Binyamin Espinoza. He wrote a book on Diktuk, but he's quoted by the Chida and the Yosef Ometz, and this passage was made famous by the Chida in halachic literature. This is what he says. Espinoza, today we'd say, that's a Jewish name? Yes, that's a Jewish name, Espinoza. Quote, Shekol davar shahum morgal b'tzibur. Every matter that it's the common practice in the tzibur, ra'oi l'smoch alav. You should depend on it. The Elohim divrei navi. Just like this is said by a navi. The Chasam Sofer says that anyone who questions minhagei kol Yisrael, sarich bedika acharav. You have to worry about him. You have to check in him. You know, is he really a religious person? This is the major change that we have in the modern era. That, and this is what Soloveitchik speaks about in his article, Eruption and Reconstruction, that the Minhag Yisrael, the practice of the Jewish people, no longer has the assumption of validity. That has been undermined. And lacking this, strong belief and trust in Minhag, people revert to the book. they find comfort in the book. Everyone who read Soloveitchik's article assumed that he was lamenting this. And he looked back with nostalgia on the day that the book tradition was not dominant, but the home tradition was. In fact, at the very end of his article, he speaks about how when he went to Ponevezh, he saw Talmidei Chachamim there, but he didn't feel the connection to the divine that he had with the ignorant Jews in Boston, who didn't have an intellectual Judaism, but were connected just in this emotional way. Now, Soloveitchik has said 100 times since that article that everyone has misunderstood him, and now he's taken to writing that it's his own fault. He obviously miswrote it or didn't write it properly, because if all these smart people are coming to the conclusion that they're coming to, then he must have written it incorrectly. All I can say is read what he writes. You get to this issue we discussed over Shabbos. You have the author of a text saying one thing and everyone else reading it saying something else. It's very hard to read his article. It could be that when he wrote it, his inner feelings were coming out consciously. He didn't even realize that he was expressing this position, his sympathy with the old-fashioned Judaism as opposed to the newfangled text culture. If in his conscious mind he's saying, no, I'm just analyzing the situation. I'm not expressing an opinion. I'm a historian. Well, you know, sometimes we can analyze an author and come to conclusions which even the author himself or herself are not completely aware of. That's basic to the way we study modern texts. Let me just read you something also from Soloveitchik. Quote from his collected essays, volume 1, page 255. Once the existing becomes identified with the appropriate, as it does in any vibrant traditional society, this identity can easily spill over and legitimize practices that fall beyond the halachic perimeter. In other words, once the existing becomes identified with the appropriate, once what people do is assumed to be correct, that can legitimize practices that are really beyond the halachic perimeter. That is, practices that by all rights should be regarded as outside halacha become accepted. Now, I'm going to give you examples of this, a number of examples next time. What I want to say, though everything I've said so far, I'll give you some few examples today, is really in line with what Frankl's position is. So why is everything we've seen so far, why is Frankl so controversial? Why was he not regarded as an ally of the Orthodox against the Reformers? I mean, some did regard him as an ally. Ritzir Shchayes regarded him as an ally and others. But Israel Hildesheimer did not, and Shamshon Raphael Hirsch not only did not regard him as an ally, he regards him as no less than a heretic. And that is not only because of what we're talking about now, which Hirsch was not comfortable with, but in particular, we're going to see what Frankl says next class in his book Darchei HaMishnah. And it's one thing to talk about post-Talmudic halacha, to talk about the Rishonim coming up with new ideas. Okay, that could be a little bit controversial, but we're not talking about actual Torah Shebaal Peh in its original state. Those who follow the debates in the Orthodox world, you know that if there's a whole school of thought that you have to assume that the sages of the Talmud have a certain infallibility. If you assume that they were missing something or they didn't know something or got something wrong, that's what's heretical. No one, it might be disrespectful, but no one's going to say it's heretical to say, for instance, that the Bali Tosavot did not know about this scientific fact or that scientific fact. The real issue with Frankl is going to be how he describes halacha in the Talmudic period, as we see in Darchei HaMishnah, and in particular, what we're going to see about Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. But we're going to see that, and we're going to see also, does he have a leg to stand on? That is, does Frankl have a leg to stand on just from traditional sources? I have to tell you, though, that although Hirsch is going to be very opposed to Frankl, Geiger was also very opposed to Frankl. In fact, when the Breslau Seminary opened, that's the first seminary, rabbinical seminary in Germany, opens in 1854, Geiger he ridicules it. He published the Bechina that Frankl gave to the students, and he ridicules it. It's like a traditional Talmudic Bechina where they have to learn Gemara. And Geiger's attitude was, this is a rabbinical seminary. He saw Frankel as just like another ish halacha who's completely behind the times. Hirsch, however, was also just as opposed, and Hirsch even published an open letter asking Frankel to explain the religious principles by which his new seminary would be guided. So we will, we're going to pick up with that next class. But before I go to that, I want to give you some other examples of what it is that really just to show why many in the Orthodox world did not have the reaction of Hirsch. I told you that Hildesheimer had also was opposed to Frankel, but after Frankel's death, he refers to him more positively. And a big part of the issue with Frankel was who he allowed to teach in his seminary. It's very similar to what happened in New York with JTS. Heinrich Gretz. Frankel allowed Heinrich Gretz to teach at the seminary. Now, how could Frankel allow Gretz because with Gretz's ideas? That's the same issue that Finkelstein had with allowing Mordechai Kaplan. So we're going to get to that. But if what I've shown you already isn't enough to understand why at least many in the Orthodox world did not have the same reaction as Hirsch did, I already told you that Jacob Weinberg also did not have a negative reaction to Frankel. Let me give you some others examples of this. There's a halacha, undisputed halacha, that you cannot, you find this in all the Gemara, the Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, you cannot lend money without witnesses. You can't lend money to someone without witnesses. And the reason is because the person might forget, then he'll deny that he owes you the money, and then he's stealing. So to prevent that, you need to have witnesses. Look around. Who every time you lend money, you call over witnesses, you write it. No one's been doing it for hundreds or thousands of years. Already the Acharonim, at least many hundreds of years, ask the question, why don't people lend money? Why do they lend money without interest? It's often formulated as Al ma somchim ha'olam. What does the world rely on? That doesn't mean that the post scheme, I think you have a certain naivete that they're assuming that because these are religious communities, there must be some justification. Many post scheme, however, are no better, and they understand that this developed simply because the people were too lazy and they didn't want to. But the post scheme still have an approach that we don't want Klal Yisrael to be seen as sinners, so it's a great mitzvah to find, for example, the Rashtam or Shmuel de Medina says it's appropriate to expend great efforts to try to find some halachic permission if you see everyone violating something. So you have many who don't use this language. And even when they use the language, Almas somchim ha'olam, what does the world rely on? For many of them, it's just a way of formulating. It doesn't mean that they really think that the people, that the justification they're going to come up with, like they're going to come up with the fact, well, maybe the people rely on this ritva. Here, the masses do what the masses want. They don't know about this ritva. But here's an example of where the people stopped observing the halacha, and the post scheme in the first generation scream and that this is incorrect. But then later generations, when the people refuse to follow what the post scheme had said, and they have this notion that it's a kilo kadosha, then you move into the next step, which is trying to be melamed zchus, trying to find some justification. And when they're done with it, now you have a new standard. That whereas it used to be you have to lend money with the witnesses, now you don't have to because we're melamed zchus. How about eating wet food? Do you know there's a halacha that if you have food that's wet, you have to eat it? That's how it's decided. And yes, you have Rishonim who have a different opinion, but that's not how it's decided because we don't observe all the purity and impurity, but this is how the halacha appears in the Gemara, in the early codes, in the Shulchan Aruch. We do it on Pesach, but other times we don't. And many poskim are very upset with this. But the people didn't do it. Why didn't the people do it? Probably because the people found it too difficult. So you have many poskim who say, we are going to, because everyone's not doing it, we have to assume there has to be some justification. We have to find the justification. And they look and they find it. That's all Frankelian. And that's what Frankel was saying, that when the people as a whole, the religious people, stop following a practice, then we can assume that this is in line with divine revelation, that this is what God wants, and we don't need to try to push the people back to observe it, because when the religious community, from their own intuition, pushes a practice out and stops following it, that gives legitimacy to the non-observance. We're not talking about eating treif or anything like that. We're talking about rabbinic practices or minhagim. How about leaving a corner of the house empty in memory of the Beis HaMikdash? People stop doing this. Maritz Chayas has a whole essay in which he deals with all these practices, which, according to the law, we should be doing it. One of them he gives is leaving a quarter of the house empty. This is the exact sort of practice that today, with a return to the textual culture, you'll find people doing it. But we know people stopped doing it, and we know that the poskim were very upset, and then they tried to find justifications for it. So if you find poskim whose language is that the people stopped doing it, and perhaps we can say they rely on this and they find some rishon, how is that different than what Frankel's saying? So I think this is really why many traditional Orthodox figures were not so turned off by Frankel's understanding of halacha, even if they would be turned off by what he has to say in the area of dogma. We're going to see halacha Moshe Sinai. That's going to be a more complicated case. I have to say, in my opinion, for what it's worth, Frankel's understanding of halacha, especially post-Talmudic halacha developments, can be justified as and is in line with a whole slew of post-scheme and how they understand it. The more problematic issue, which we're going to get to next class, is when he deals with Torah Shebaal Peh, the issue of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. Because here it could be that the way he historicizes the halacha does cross lines, maybe crosses the Rambam's line, maybe it's... I'm not going to say it means he's no longer in the Orthodox world, because he's not in the Orthodox world. He's in a separate world. But does Frankel's idea of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai remove him from what we would regard as the traditionalist world? That is, the people who follow traditional Torah teachings. Or in this matter too, maybe can we find some justification? That's going to be more complicated because it gets into dogma. But before we do that, I actually have two more things I want to show you, which I'll do next class, because I see it's already time. I want to show you something from Rav Chaim Hirschenson, which also reads just like it's Frankel, and then Rav Kook. Now you can understand maybe why a lot of people didn't care for Rav Chaim Hirschenson and also Rav Kook. But to wait till you see next week what Rav Kook says. Because of all these sources I'm showing you, I really say, and I would say this to anyone in Washington Heights, that I agree there's what to discuss when we get to the oral law and Frankel's understanding, Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, how he views the whole understanding of the oral law. But if you deal with the development of halacha subsequent to the closing of the Talmud, I really don't feel, despite what Hirsch might have thought, I don't feel that his understanding... It's definitely in line with the academic approach to halacha, and it's in line with so many halachic authorities, the way they describe the power of a kehila kadosha, and that if the Jewish community, the religious community, does something, we assume that God's presence, as it were, is there, and he would not allow the Jewish community and all the rabbis just to be wrong in this matter. You find so many examples, in particular in the Hasidic world. If all the Hasidic rabbis were doing this, then it must be in line with halacha. So next class, we'll finally get to the real controversial matter, and then the rubber hits the road, as they say, and we'll have to make judgments about where to put Frankel. But okay, let me... Zahav says, am I traveling on the first day? Well, no, I'm not traveling on the first day. I'm saying that if you're a... You mean the second day? If you're, I think you're referring to what I said, that if you're, according to the Shulchan Aruch, if you're an Israeli, you could fly from Israel to America. It says, here, I'll show you. The language of the Shulchan Aruch, it's, B'nei Eretz Yisrael Shebaal Chutzaretz, Asur Masos Malcha B'yom Tov Sheini B'Yishuv. If you come from Eretz Yisrael to Chutzaretz, if you're just walking in the desert, you can do malacha. But once you reach the yeshuv, afil data lachzor, even if you intend to go back, Zachosman Shlohegil Yeshuv, a few ain't at Alachsar Mutar. But as long as you haven't reached the Yeshuv, then you can do Malacha. Lefisha Dain Lahukba Rios Kamosan. Aval in Higiel Yeshuv. But if you came to the settlement, the ain't at Alachsar, Nasa Kamosan. Okay, then if you came to it and you're not going to head back, Nasa Kamosan V'Asar Bein B'Midbar Bein Yeshuv. If you come from Israel and then you're not going to return, then you're like a chutznik wherever you go. What I think the Chiddush of Rav Schechter, and I've heard this in his name, I never asked him about this, but I've heard him, in fact, as I recall, I even heard him on tape say this. He says, if you fly from Israel and you're at the airport, you still can, and it's the second day of Yom Tov, since you're not in the Yishuv, you can be over on Malacha there. This is assuming, see, that a Yishuv means a Jewish community, and it means a religious Jewish community. Because if you arrive in Newark Airport, you're going to have Jews there. The airport's full of Jews, but they're just the irreligious Jews. So, I mean, I could see an argument that once you get to, that if you're in the airport, that you couldn't fly, because once you're in the airport, you have to do malacha, or maybe you don't have to do malacha, well, maybe that's not malacha when you land. But once you get off the airplane, you're in the airport, there are Jews around. Unless you say, since these are Mechalei Shabbos, they don't count. And I think that's probably what his argument is. But everyone would agree. Now, let's say you're in Eretz Yisrael and you walk into the deserts of Jordan or wherever, or maybe that's biblical Eretz Yisrael. So you walk into some place which is not Eretz Yisrael, that you're not bound on the second day. Lick says that the Ramban holds that Lo Susor doesn't apply to Derabanan. See, it's the big dispute between Rabbi Chanan Wasserman has a whole piece on this, because if Lo Sasor applies to Derabanan, then what's a Derab? Then nothing's a Derabanan. If you say that there's a Torah prohibition not to violate, if there's a Torah obligation to listen to the rabbis, and if you that means that if you violate a Derabanan, you're violating a Daraisa, then what? Then it's a paradox. Then what's a Derabanan? If every Derabanan is a Daraisa, then what's a Rabbi Chanan Wasserman? The Kovetz Mamarim, I think it's the Kovetz Mamarim, has a whole essay on this. And thank you, Mike, for calling my attention last class that I misspoke about the dishwasher. Eric says, can we get some examples of changes that came more from the bottom up rather from Gedolim? The ones I just gave you a bunch of them. We have other ones. So, for instance, women. We know that women in Ashkenaz didn't say brachos during the time of Nida. How is that possible? The Mishnah never, the Gemara never says that. They didn't go to shul, but they didn't say brachos at all. How could you not say brachos? There's an obligation to say a bracha rishona. So we have lots of practices that mezuzah. In medieval Ashkenaz, they didn't do mezuzahs. They did it, in the front of the house, but they didn't do it throughout the rest of the house. These are practices that, for whatever reason, they didn't do. And sometimes they try to be Muhammad Schus. Other times, if they think it's so blatant, it's Doraisa, they try harder to abolish it. And sometimes the rabbis try to abolish it, but other rabbis defend it. As I said last class, one rabbi's minhag mevatal halacha is another rabbi's who says that the letters of minhag equal Gehenim. And we have to abolish it. M.H. Laserson, your discussion about normative Judaism versus text Judaism recalls certain debates in the sociology of law about difference in law in the books and law in action. Exactly. That is correct. And Soloveitchik, in response to his critics, gets into some of this legal theory as well. Look, those who study law know that there's different ways of interpreting the law. The formalist position, does a judge take into account, does a judge start with this assumption that this is what it should be? And is he allowed to bring in all his personal feelings to try to move the law in one direction? Or should just be concerned with the legal literature? There's just like you have different theories of law, there are debates, theories of halakha. And you find major authorities on both, I'm talking about academic authorities, on different sides of this issue on how to understand halakha, how halakha works, because you find all sorts of different statements that push in different directions. So each side really is able to cite sources. I think the answer is which side is more in line with the general tenor. Because you can find individual sources saying all sorts of things, but which approach to Jewish law is in line with the general tenor of the sources? What notions exist, Justin says, that during various times tefillin were conceptual and not practical? I didn't say conceptual and not practical. I'm not talking about, let's say, some Karaite understanding of tefillin or some the Rashbam. The Rashbam interprets tefillin al pi upshat as not being literal. I'm not saying that any Torah, any traditional Jew, that is, Jew who lived in Jewish community in medieval times, interpreted the halakha that way and because of that didn't wear tefillin. We just know that people didn't wear it. And the reason is that they probably thought that. Who says you have to wear it all the time? Where does it say in the Torah that I have to wear it every day? Once in a blue moon, I'll put it on. If I miss today, you can see in the popular mind, just like tzitzis. That people would say, yeah, they'd come up with the Balabatish understandings of it. We don't have anything really from the people because they were not the rabbis. What we have is the rabbis. Things, it could just be that it fell out of fashion. Sometimes halachot just fall out of fashion and people stop doing it. It could be that it was too expensive. They couldn't afford it. People stopped buying it. Then it became a practice, like a practice only for the pious, not for the average. I can tell you that in North Africa, the practice was the only rabbis wore tzitzis. The average person didn't wear tzitzis. So now why is that the practice? It could be that it was very hot, so people stopped wearing it and only the rabbis wore it. So then it became from what it began as just because it was hot, then that became a minhag. And therefore it actually was the practice that that only the rabbis wear it. That's how minhagim develop. If you look in rabbinic sources, you have a couple ways minhagim are described. Some of them, including the Rambam, speaks of minhagim that the rabbis institute, actual minhagim instituted by the rabbis, and others speak in terms of minhagim that come from the people. I think the answer is both. Some minhagim were established by the authorities, and others, probably most, came from bottom up. You say, could, aside from the commandments, it seems no actual description of anyone using tefillin anywhere else in Tanakh. Yeah, I don't think, I mean, we know they wore tefillin in Bayit Sheni, and but I just think it could be that it was expensive. I mean, the halacha is you have to buy your son a tefillin. Tefillin are not cheap, and you need a sofer. In medieval times, just like we spoke last class, how would you get an esrog? It's not so simple. How would you get a tefillin? How many sofrim are there? It's very difficult to. You have to pay a lot of money. Jews didn't have money, so it's easy to see how that could have fallen by the wayside. Maybe it began that there was one pair of tefillin in shul, so everyone has to use that pair of tefillin. But if there's only one pair of tefillin, by the time you get you're gonna wait an hour till you get your chance for tefillin. You'll say, I'll come back later. And then, these practices, it could develop in that sort of way. I don't know why mezuzah, why the practice developed that they weren't makpid on mezuzah so much. That I don't know. If you're interested in this, Kannerfogel, in the Ephraim Kannerfogel, in the volume put out by the Orthodox Forum, Jewish, I forgot the title of it, Jewish Practice, something like that, Jewish Observance, Medieval, Modern, I don't know the exact title, it's something like that. He has an article on non-observance in medieval times and the response of the Rishonim. We're accustomed to think that it's only with the rise of Reform people aren't observing halachot. It's not true. We know that in the times of Gemara, people didn't observe things, and we know that in the times of Rishonim, people didn't observe things. So you have all the sources in Kannerfogel's article. And someone privately texts me that's Rabbi Chanan in the Kovetz Shiurim, not the Kovetz Mamarim. He discusses it. And Jared says normative versus prescriptive. Shkoyach for that. I see. Okay, we are complete. And I thank you all for coming out tonight, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, I was just looking. I have to look at my Orthodox forum, but we have the Carnifugal article. But okay, I'll take a look afterwards. Anyways, okay, thank you. All right, tomorrow at 11 a.m., Nava Finkelman continues her series on foreigners in the Bible, and follow that 1 p.m. Eastern by Rabbi Shulman's continuing series on Sefer Daniel. All right, and then our regular shiurim Wednesday, Thursday. The parshiur this week is giving by Rabbi Yitzchak Et Shalom of L.A., from L.A. He's spoken a number of times before. And, okay, we look forward to seeing you. Please invite a friend, and everybody should have a nice night. I think the snow's on its way, I think, pretty soon. But, okay, and I don't know. It depends where you live, of course. But, all right, Laila Tov. Thank you, Dr.
Todah Rabah, Laila Tov.
Laila Tov, everybody. Okay, be well. Thank you very much.